Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. This is Alex Linder and I'm at vnnforum.com, also my own homepage, alexlinder.com. Today we're going to conclude The Ordeal of Civility, the book that was my personal epiphany to the true depth, the true horrifying depth of the Jewish network against whites. Which I read back when I was 25, by John Murray Cudahy. We recorded everything we record. You can find it via VNN Forum and when it's finished at alexlinder.com. And we've done this book in about, I don't know, 12 sessions maybe. This will be the last. We're going to cover chapter 23, which is also part 5, part V, the conclusion, he calls it. Modernity, Jewry, Christianity. Page 223 up through 238. A couple of those sort of blanks, so it really starts on 225. Chapter 23, Modernity, Jewry, Christianity. Let's dig into it now. Begins with an epigraph from Isaiah Berlin. But the strangers we speak of are unique in retaining their peculiar attributes, especially their religious views, while stoutly denying that these peculiarities are of crucial importance or relevant to their relationship to the society in which they dwell. This attitude rests on an illusion which is nevertheless, for the most part, sincerely and honorably accepted as a reality by both sides, but which, being half felt as delusive, communicates a sense of desperate embarrassment to those who seek to examine it, as if a mystery were being approached to the belief in the non-existence of which both sides are pledged, yet the reality of which both at least suspect. Cudahy now says, several ideas that run like an obligato through this book must now, in the conclusion, be picked up and thematized for their own sakes. One of these is the curious secret adversary relationship of the secular Jewish intellectual to the Jewish bourgeoisie, that is, the ordinary Jewish middle-class community. The intellectual is sensitive and refined. The bourgeoisie, obviously, is vulgar. Undeniable as their vulgarity may be in his eyes, the secular Jewish intellectual almost never allows himself to come out and say so explicitly. In this matter, all, excepting Marx, have observed, more or less faithfully, the 11th or diaspora commandment, "Thou shalt not reveal in-group secrets to the goyim." As a result of this self-censorship, this secret intra-ethnic war has been encoded in various ways in the literary and ideological product of the Jewish social critics of the diaspora. Diaspora creativity is thus a form of, quote, secret writing, unquote, enciphering covert Jewish, quote, family understandings. The opera omnia of the diaspora tradition constitute, in one degree or another, hermeneutic systems, interpretive systems, in which the Jew pays real, the real country, must be read between the lines of the pays legal, the legal country. So what the law is or what it's said to be, you have to, the reality is between the lines. In earlier times, quote, when Jews spoke a language of their own, they could criticize and admonish each other without worrying about giving ammunition to their enemies, writes Milton Himmelfarb. In a quite literal sense, Norman Denison notes, both Jewish German and Yiddish could serve, quote, among other functions, as concealment codes, unquote. For Yiddish speakers, living mainly among non-German speakers, a German-derived linguistic structure in itself went a long way towards meeting the need for concealment. Speakers of Jewish German, on the other hand, lived among German speakers, and hence for them, quote, an extensive special vocabulary was necessary. Typical of the concealment function of German Jewish is the use of Hebrew numerals, of considerable importance to dealers discussing prices and wares in private, or write it on the tag so non-Yiddish speakers don't know it, or non-Hebrew speakers. After emancipation and writing in French, German, English, and other tongues, the fear of, by Jewish writers of being suddenly overheard, quote-unquote, built into secular diaspora writing, a subtler variety of, quote, normal esotericism, esoteric, yeah, on the inside versus exoteric on the outside. Neocon, Leo Strauss, these are all the words you associate with this. One message for the masses, another for the insiders. A self-enforcing self-censorship, a taboo on the public ventilation of tribal secrets, quote-unquote, maintained in the name of prudence and, quote, social responsibility, unquote, became common practice. The fear of, quote, persecution, unquote, political and social, had created a secret writing, asterisk, which reads, the writing style of the late Professor Leo Strauss, quote, erudite, elliptical, abstract, as Irving Kristol, the father of the neocons, notes, was a self-exemplifying instance of his own thesis in Persecution and the Art of Writing. Irving Kristol, Social Sciences and the Law, The Great Ideas Today, 1962, Chicago, Encyclopedia Britannica, 1962, page 243. Back to the text. What happened to what Professor Daniel Aaron, in Some Reflections on Communism and the Jewish Writer, describes as the radical Jewish intellectual's own hostility toward the vulgar Jewish Philistine, whose unashamed drive for social status struck them as particularly reprehensible? What happened to them? Where did this hostility, this undeclared intra-ethnic war, go? It disappeared publicly, displaced and universalized, this is the nuanced meaning I give to esoteric, into a general indictment of bourgeois Western capitalism as a whole. The key phrase here is the unashamed drive of the Jewish bourgeoisie, Marx's and Lippmann's primal scene. It was the complex fate of the acculturated Jewish radical intellectual to feel shame that the ordinary, unashamed Jews were not feeling, and to perform on an intellectual cultural level those rites of Goffman's remedial interchange in the form of apology and explanation to the goyim, Marxism, Stalinism, Trotskyism, that ordinary prost Jews were remiss in performing on the everyday social level. Another asterisk. Ironically, the more acculturated Jewish critics of the 50s were to attack, in turn, this high-minded 30s politics, the Rosenbergs were the target, to demonstrate, Morris Dickstein writes, its underlying vulgarity of mind. For Leslie Fielder and Robert Warshaw, the vulgar middle-brow Jew is a cultural embarrassment who must be exorcised. This attack is, quote, understandable, however unforgivable. What was buried with the Rosenbergs was two decades of American and Jewish Marxism, end quote. Morris Dickstein, Cold War Blues, Notes on the Culture of the 50s, Partisan Review, 41, number 1, 1974, page 48, 49. Back to the text. The vulgar Jewish Philistine's trip to Miami has, in a sense, created the Jewish intellectual trip, the ideological pilgrimage to Moscow, so that the vulgar Jews go to Miami and the intellectual Marxist Jews go to Moscow. The hidden injury of shame at Miami, the fear of vulgarity by association, creates that, quote, world elsewhere, which is Moscow. Let us call it the M&M phenomenon. Miami becomes a nightmare for the refined intellectual, generally. Robert Alter winces at, quote, the hideous ostentation, unquote, displayed in Miami by the children and grandchildren of the Lower East Side. Even in Tel Aviv, Cynthia Ozick finds, quote, an arrogant row of Miami-like hotels. A striking parallel to the exasperated snobbery felt by the Jewish intellectual elite for its bourgeois Jewish community emerges in the way the British left feels about its working class vacation land, Blackpool. Blackpool maddens the English ideological left, Peregrine Wursthorn notes, because it, quote, shows the working class as it really is, rather than as the left would like it to be. It shows them to be, block quote here, it shows the British working class to be, as opposed to leftist ideology, resolutely old-fashioned, provocatively insular, shockingly lowbrow, persistently racialist, unashamedly vulgar, very easily pleased with very little, the very opposite, that is, of what socialism would wish them to be. There they are, walking down the front, gawping, drinking, leering, having a wonderful time, now, in this unreconstructed capitalist hell, showing no awareness that they are living in a cultural desert, displaying no desire for higher standards, no concern about the race relations, behaving, in short, with a brazen naturalness without the slightest reference to any canons of taste and propriety other than their own. A museum piece of genuine working-class culture. For the progressive, Blackpool is a nightmare. They have got the rest of us on the run. But Blackpool refuses to budge. So the ones who've grown up and been to college are a little easier to cow ideologically than the true working class, which is always going to be scummy and vulgar. And low rent. This recoil from the vulgarity of their own Jewish community, in which we find the covert root of the social and literary creativity of the diaspora intellectuals, is not a matter confined to the West. One thinks of Russia and Babel's creative ambivalence about the Polish Ostjuden. There are Chernikovsky and Mandelstam. Quote, "But how offensive was the speech of the rabbi, though it was not ungrammatical," recalls Osip Mandelstam of a trip, childhood trip to the synagogue in the Jewish quarter of St. Petersburg. How vulgar when he uttered the words, "His Imperial Highness," how utterly vulgar all that he said. But synagogues were, in a sense, Jewish private places. In the West, with urbanization and the emergence of the social category, the, quote, "Jewish problem," unquote, was to become the problem of social appearance as such, the problem of creating scenes in urban public places like streets, parks, and public halls. It was no longer the charge made by anti-Semites of, quote, "hidden, behind-the-scenes manipulations by Jewish financiers." It was the anguish of acculturated Jews at the public behavior of their fellow Jews. When in 1897, the same year as Herzl's first Zionist Congress, Walter Rathenau writes his pseudonymous manifesto, "Hear, O Israel," he opens by insisting on the visibility of, quote, "the Jewish problem. Whoever wishes to see it," he writes, "should wander through the Tiergartenstrasse at 12 o'clock on a Berlin Sunday morning, or else look into the foyer of a theater in the evening. Strange sight." This aversion of the socially assimilating Jew to the loud and conspicuous public behavior of his fellow Jews is the functional equivalent of the disdain of the Jewish intellectual for the vulgarity of the Jewish community. The ancient, quote, "Jewish problem," unquote, had surfaced as a problem of behavior in public places, a problem of relations in public, bequeathing to the Jewish intellectual his problem of public relations. It was a problem of social aesthetics. Asterisk. This, for the sociologist in any case, is how one must construe Cynthia Ozick's statement that, quote, "the problem of diaspora in its most crucial essence, is the problem of aesthetics," close quote. America toward Yavneh, Yavneh, Judaism 19, number 3, summer 1970, 273. Nothing in the ethos of Yiddishkeit had prepared its sons for this demoralizing differentiation in social life of morals from manners. Another asterisk, and nothing had prepared them for that later Weberian disenchantment, Max Weber, the differentiation of morals from politics. Quote, "If there is any lesson to be learned," writes Professor Danto ruefully about the Sorelian general strike at Columbia University, 1968, "it is that flexibility and compromise, while morally repugnant, are the soul of politics." Arthur C. Danto, 2, Columbia, The Useless Lesson, The New Republic, 160, number 4, January 25th, 1969, colon, 26, a review of Up Against the Wall, Up Against the Ivy Wall, A History of the Columbia Crisis by Jeffrey L. Avorn, A-V-O-R-N, comma, Robert Friedman, and members of the staff of Columbia Daily Spectator. And the text again. And nothing, okay, so nothing in the ethos of Yiddishkeit had prepared its sons for this demoralizing differentiation in social life of morals and manners. And nothing in the ethos of Yiddishkeit had prepared them for the analogous ordeal of differentiation in the life of culture, namely The distinction of fiction from legend and history. Now that's very interesting. I say on the day Elie Wiesel died yesterday, or was it today? Nothing in the ethos of Yiddishkeit had prepared them for the analogous ordeal of differentiation in the life of culture, namely the distinction of fiction from legend and history. In the West, these two differentiations hang together. If your culture has fiction, your social life will probably have behavior, for behavior is a kind of fictive or ideal element in social interaction. C.S. Lewis pinpoints in The Age of Sidney and Spencer the critical debate of 16th century critics as the time of, quote, the difficult process by which Europe became conscious of fiction as an activity distinct from history on the one hand and from lying on the other. Not until some 300 years later, as part of its delayed modernization, did diaspora Jewry take its first steps in that difficult process. It's still not completed, since they lie about everything. In 1853, there appeared a novel, or rather a melodramatic biblical, quote, romance, unquote, written by a maskil, M-A-S-K-I-L, of the Hebrew movement of Enlightenment, Haskalah. Titled The Love of Zion and written by Abraham Mapu, it constituted for its Jewish readers their, quote, very first introduction to the very concept of literature as such, unquote. But in general, the idea of fiction has remained a stranger to the world of Yiddishkeit. East European Jews, Alfred Kazin notes, have produced many stories, narratives, legends, but until our day, very little fiction. Like other modernizing peoples, the Jews, in moving from towns and shtetlach into the urban public space of the modern city, were thrust among a world of strangers. In the small towns of their past, their personal and family worlds, and the world of their ethnic family, were coextensive with their spatial worlds. On opening the door in the shtetl, they had been instantly surrounded by relatives, friends, enemies, neighbors, acquaintances, or, at the very least, by fellow Jews. Quote, life is with people, as they say. But when, in Vienna, Paris, Berlin, London, and New York, when Jewish city dwellers who had left their ethnic enclaves of first settlement opened their front doors and stepped out into an urban public space belonging to no one in particular, they were instantly engulfed by strangers. Life is with strangers, all hyphenated. To tolerate the continued co-presence of strange others without personally knowing them, that is, without coding them instantly as friend or foe, is a difficult feat for any still tradition-directed people. The social exigencies of behaving in a seemly way in a world of strangers, as a, quote, stranger among strangers, requires that one has in one's behavioral repertoire a certain, quote, ritual competence, as Irving Goffman calls it, that traditionally falls under the rubric of civility. For what fundamentally does stranger mean in the modern liberal era of the city of strangers, but a fellow user of a public place? And what kind of code did modern liberalism, which it, at its best, Benjamin Nelson reminds us, quote, looks at the very least to the advent of a certain kind of brotherhood, a brotherhood in which all are brothers in being equally others, unquote, hope would replace the ancient brother-enemy code, but a code that would transform otherness into the tertium quid of civility. Thus, out of an intolerance of the ambiguity of the surrounding stranger to travel in packs in public spaces, to transform public space into a private or semi-private space, privatizing it by creating a mobile home, is perceived by the co-present strangers as an intrusion, as acting as if they own the place, the space, as, in a word, creating a social delict that symbolically subverts liberalism's secret wish for the new equality of a purely civil kind of brotherhood. The depth of Walter Rathenau's acculturation to the core values of Protestant individualistic Calvinism is revealed by his, quote, overreaction, unquote, to the unseemly group intrusion by his fellow Jews into the impersonal public Protestant space of the modern Gesellschaft society. Gesellschaft means society. He experienced their vulgar religiosity, that is, as a profanation. The older question is Jewry Salons Fähig, is it worthy of a salon? they know how to act, that is, fit for the salon, passes into the later question, is Jewry gesellschaftsfähig? That is it fit for a modern civil society? These social questions, as we have seen in our chapter on the entry of Jewish characters into the modernist novel, are Jews romansfähig, novel capable, fit for the modernist novel, are continuous to some extent with cultural problems. For question of fitness, appropriateness, and propriety are all, in the end, matters of aesthetic, not moral or political judgment. And when recently Meyer Levin in The Obsession, his book, revealed to the public the quarrel with his rival dramatizers of Anne Frank's Diary of a Young Girl, he claiming they had bleached out her Jewishness, they claiming that, quote, my work was unstageworthy, unquote. Do we not hear the question, are Jews bühnenfähig, that is, are they fit for the stage? Asterisk. Reads, 25 years earlier in his autobiographical In Search, Meyer Levin had performed the self-criticism he now asks of others. I had tried to erase what was Jewish in my characters. I was influenced by Hemingway's terse manner of writing. I began to struggle with the Jewish element first by trying quite unconsciously to pass, as in Reporter and Frankie and Johnny, where I eliminated the Jewishness of my characters. Meyer Levin, In Search, New York Paperback Library, 1961, pages 34-472. Everything, it would seem, has always conspired to maintain and justify the tradition of hidden self-censorship and the public relations orientation in the diaspora. Politeness, respectability, an era of anti-Semitism in the Holocaust, a time of cultural philo-Semitism, the fear by Jews of the label self-hate and by Gentiles of the label anti-Semite, both functioning as instruments of social control. Everything, it seems, conspires to legitimate submerging whole dimensions of the experience of diaspora Judaism, where it does not actually falsify that experience itself. No Jew is free as long as telling the truth is eo ipso to become an informer to the goyim. Leslie Fielder, after exploring Carl Shapiro's tergiversations, that is, apostasies or treason, in the attempt to rewrite his own past, confesses, quote, we are all spiritual Stalinists engaged in a continual falsification of our own histories. We must pray for critics capable of pointing this out, end quote. The nearest cultural parallel in this respect to the ideological secret writing of the diaspora giants is, curiously, the writings of the Puritan divines, who were eventually to find their greatest critic, or their great critic, in the late Perry Miller. To understand the Mathers, Cotton Mather, Pilgrim's Progress and such, to understand the Mathers, Miller maintained, it is necessary, block quote here, that we appreciate the habit of speech that grew up in New England as an inevitable concomitant to the Jeremiads. References had to be phased in more and more generalized terms, names never explicitly named, so that we are obliged to decipher out of oblique insinuations what to contemporaries were broad designations. When ministers, read radical secular Jewish intellectuals, denounced oppression and luxury, they meant certain people whom they did not have to specify to their flocks. This habit of ambiguity developed out of New England's insecurity, out of its inability to face frankly its own internal divisions, out of its efforts to maintain a semblance of unity, even while unanimity was crumbling. Which became more elaborate and disingenuous as internecine passions waxed, was to cling to the New England mind for centuries. We look ahead to the decades in which an emerging Unitarianism swathed itself in terms of studied vagueness. In Boston society today, matters may be fully discussed which, to an outsider, seem never to be mentioned at all. So they go more and more away from abstractions, the more and more hatred of pointed, direct, blunt, bald speech. I don't fully understand what he's saying, why they're doing that, but that's what he's saying. That was a culture that developed. And he's saying it's somewhat similar to see what developed among Jews. They're trying to speak to each other in code and not show things to outsiders. Miller was to crack, leaving the block quote, Miller was to crack the cryptogram of this tribal reticence, as he calls it, in concluding the above passage in the Mathers and Jonathan Edwards and in the New England mind generally. A similar work of reclamation, opening out the great secular Jewish rabbis and their covert Jeremiads against their own, is an idea whose time, I think, has come, says Cudahy. For what is a Jewish intellectual in the first place but a person, in Bernard Rosenberg's definition, who pretends to have forgotten his Yiddish? And they really do hide that. I mean, I had a friend in college who was Jewish, who I knew quite well. I may have mentioned this before. We were both big students of language. And, you know, we'd talked about stuff literally for years. And then one day, out of the blue, there was another Jew that he was talking to. And somehow something about, as I recall, Hebrew school. And it emerged that he knew, like, Hebrew. Never ever mentioned that. So they have, and this is someone I knew pretty well. And it really kind of, at that point, he was my friend. He was a Jew. He was very much of a leftist. And, you know, we would argue about different stuff. And, you know, you come to understand, help me understand how Jews generally think about things. And it just that in itself doesn't tell you everything. But when you later read books like this, and you come across the phrase, they're British in public, or Yiddish in private, it puts it all, you're like, yeah, these people are not, they're not just leftist, as I kind of vaguely thought for a lot of my young life. I didn't like them because they were basically always leftist, communist, pushing. A, they were pushing bad ideas. B, they were getting respect that in my eyes growing up they did not deserve. C, a lot of that respect, I say, or B, they were getting a lot of that respect from Christians in higher places who should have known better or should have acted better. So it led me to understand increasingly dislike Jews and to really, really dislike the Christians who fawned over them. But I didn't know how to tie all of this together really until I read books like this. And I had a lot more examples from real life to draw from once I'd worked in D.C. among conservatives and seen how that operated. And that, as I've said, half the writers at the publication I was at were Jews. Just seeing what a Jewy milieu the right was as well as the left. So you need things that tie everything together. Show you the patterns. I mean, using your mind is to make subtle distinctions, as subtle as you can, but also to see as big patterns as are out there, right? And then to be able to convey that is the art, and I suppose science to an extent, but also the art to convey it as simply and memorably, humorously, as possible. That's the fun of letters. Now, for what is a Jewish intellectual in the first place but a person who pretends to have forgotten his Yiddish? Are there broader implications to this case study of Freud, Marx, Levi-Strauss, and diaspora intellectual culture generally? It would seem that there are, but the broad implications are precisely indentured to the details. We find three conclusions growing out of our study. 1. In the first place, we learn that we learn nothing about our civilization from the Christian and Jewish celebrants of what ecumenist public relations insist on calling Judeo-Christian civilization. This factitious phrase, with its facile hyphen, is part of what I have called at the beginning of chapter 22, quote, the cultural and theological illiteracy of our times. Asterisk, which reads, the notion of a Judeo-Christian civilization was never really a cultured myth. It is a sociological device. It is a device, and here we must be frank, writes Nathan Rotenstrike, to convince the non-Jewish world that they share with Jews a common tradition. It is also a device to convince the Jews that they share with the world not only the universal secular culture, but also the universal Christian cultian culture. Nathan Rotenstrike, Emancipation and Its Aftermath, in David Sidorsky, editor, The Future of the Jewish Community in America, New York Basic Books, 1973, page 52. Back to the text. So we learn nothing about our three things we learned from the study. We learn nothing from those who use Judeo-Christian civilization. This factitious phrase with its facile hyphen is part of what I have called at the beginning of chapter 22, quote, the cultural and theological illiteracy of our times. To learn the nature of the civilization of the West, we must go not to the assimilators, nor to our Chagalls and our Malamudes, nor to our Niebuhrs and our Neuhauses, but to the great unassimilated, implacable Jews of the West, to Marx, to Freud, to a Levi-Strauss, to a Harry Wolfson, to those who exhibit a principled and stubborn resistance to the whole Western thing. But see, Cudahy never talks about them, although you can get there from here, as I've said many times, trying to destroy white society. It's always about whether they want to assimilate to it, or are amazed by it, or hate it, or whatever, but it's always about their comfort and they're trying to fit in. It's never about them overtly trying to destroy it, which is what's actually going on, I believe, and I think the evidence pretty clearly shows. They overtly, never anywhere in here is it mentioned that they overtly, at most it's made that they don't understand it, the farthest he will go is to say that Western culture was undeniably more beautiful than their culture, and that they felt they looked ugly in their own eyes. It made them look ugly in their own eyes, with the hint of what that makes them feel about themselves and what reaction that might inspire them. He never touches on that. And the agreement before their emancipation that they were backwards in social hyphen civilizational ways. That's as far as he goes, but he never talks about them as an overtly negative force trying to destroy Western society, and he never but just slightly touches on the Frankfurt School, and doesn't really discuss the true politics of Jews as a team working not to fit in, but to turn white Western Christian society into something that not only feeds them, but makes them feel ensconced in comfort by racially destroying it as well as culturally destroying it. It's left for others to do that, McDonald and, me, I guess. Let's see. Now, so again, the great unassimilated, implacable Jews of the West, to a Marx, to a Freud, to a Levi-Strauss, to a Harry Wolfson, to those who exhibit a principled and stubborn resistance to the whole Western thing. These proud pariahs experience Western civilization as an incognito or secularized form of Christianity, and they therefore openly resist it as such. Professor Harry A. Wolfson, the other great Harvard scholar of Jewish philosophy and theology, puts the matter with unimpeachable authority. Looking back on a century of Jewish emancipation and writing in 1962, he openly declares of Western Jewry that, block quote, a century of infiltration of Christian ideas into our life through all the agencies of education has robbed us of our essential Jewish character, of our distinctive Jewish philosophy of life, and everything that guides our life and determines our view thereof. We have become Christianized, for we have somehow accepted Christ, if not in the theological sense of a savior, at least in the historical sense of a civilizer. We have fallen in with a prevalent view that Christianity is essential to the progress of human civilization, which is, after all, another version of the Christian belief that Christ is necessary for the salvation of one's soul. We proceed on the assumption that modern civilization is the fulfillment of the promises of Christ. This study unpacks somewhat Wolfson's somehow in the preceding passage and endeavors to spell out in some of the ways in which the differentiated modernity of the West is experienced by its more profound Jews. As a matter of the acceptance or rejection of Christ, in Wolfson's words, as a civilizer, if not as a savior. For them, the West is experienced as a standing temptation scene to religious apostasy, to universalize, to differentiate, to refine, to upgrade, to reform is eo ipso, to convert to Christianity. Some Jews turned back from the brink of this cultural conversion, deliberately reconverting to the Jewish community, becoming its spokesman. A returnee, a Baal Teshuba, in this little-known tradition of diaspora intellectuality, asterisk, this diaspora ideology, which I shall treat at length in another book, is a variant of the tradition of the conscious pariah which Hannah Arendt discusses in The Jew as Pariah, A Hidden Tradition, Jewish Social Studies 6, number 2, 1944. From Franz Rosenzweig to Cynthia Ozick in our own time, is converting, in effect, from the vulgarity which conceals to the coarseness which reveals. From Jewish parvenu assimilation to Jewish pariah Ostjudentum, from the refinement which is vulgarity to the coarseness which connotes the modern authenticity. Another asterisk reads, thus, when Martin Kilson, professor of government at Harvard College, attacks Norman Potteretz's espousal of the Jewish community's Zionism, he is specifically attacking the, quote, revolting, unquote, intellectual taste of a Jewish intellectual who has sold out to the vulgarity of the Jewish community. Quote, though one is accustomed to a certain grossness in the sensibilities of the author of Making It, he writes, I was not quite prepared for the naked display in now instant Zionism. New York Times Magazine, February 3, 1974, the nakedly crass and vulgar ethnic chauvinism surrounding his We Are All Zionists Now pronouncement to his fellow Jews is more than I expected, even from Norman Potteretz. His celebration of the new Jewish chauvinism is as politically dangerous as it is intellectually revolting. Letters, American Jewish Loyalties, New York Times Magazine, February 24, 1974, page 72. Second lesson out of all this, or finding, we have probed the question of the primitivism of the shtetl Jew and his resistance to modernization in both belief and behavior. Peculiar as it may seem as a finding, we find that a kind of pre-differentiated crudeness on the culture system level and a kind of undifferentiated rudeness on the social system level of behavior is believed to be, by certain Jews themselves, not only an integral part of what it means to be a Jew, but integral to the religious essence of Judaism, and not an accidental result of exile or of socioeconomic disadvantage. Jews are rude and crude. That's part of their religion. And how many Jews today, Michael Seltzer asks in a recent analysis of Franz Rosenzweig's Star of Redemption, how many Jews today, proudly identified during the past two or three generations with Western modernity, can join in Rosenzweig's insistence that the traditional primitivism and obscurantism of the Jews, in the eyes of their critics, is of the very essence of Judaism? It is with good reason, then, that in Chapter 9, The Temptation Scene, when Bleuler came in from Zurich to visit Freud, we felt ourselves to be in some obscure but unmistakable way witness to a religious confrontation. When Bleuler dangled the lure of Edelkeit before his eyes, it was Yiddishkeit that spoke through Freud and thundered its no. Not only Freud's genius, but the genius of all the intellectual giants of the Jewish diaspora has deep, if hidden, connections with their being consciously and deliberately, albeit helplessly, social pariahs. These hidden transformations occur not only with a Marx or a Freud in the field of the social sciences, but with an Einstein in the natural sciences as well. Quote, he hated violence and ceremony equally, Howard Moss writes in his elegy, The Gift to Be Simple. Everybody knows the polarity that was Einstein. The social pariah with the crazy hair and the rumpled sweater, the subtle and fastidious rationalist exploring the secrets of the universe. But if one probes deeper, Gerald Holton writes, one will find that these polarities are essentially connected to his scientific genius. Einstein's disinterest in making quite sure he will not turn up incorrectly dressed for some formal occasion is not unrelated to his ability to adopt an unconventional point of view when it is needed to expose the key fault in some hoary old problem of science. My emphasis, that's assuming he didn't steal or plagiarize from someone else, which is not a safe assumption. But the interconnection runs deeper than this. Einstein found the refinements and differentiations of Western social decorum and civility absolutely unfathomable, endlessly fascinating, and personally a torture. During Thomas Bucky's extended stay as a guest at Einstein's home, the physicist's only non-scientific reading was Emily Post's book on etiquette. He read the book in his bedroom study in the evenings, and his sharp laugh rattled through the house. Frequently, he came downstairs with a book in his hand and offered to read a particularly choice passage on the proper conduct of a gentleman. Einstein's friends, Bucky continues, never expected him to behave in the conventional manner. Since my fiancée and I knew how Einstein was tortured by formal occasions, we didn't invite him to our wedding in 1953 at the Plaza in New York. He showed up, he concludes, without being invited. Over the fireplace in Fine Hall at Princeton, Einstein's famous line is inscribed, "Raffiniert ist Herr Gott, aber boshaft ist nicht." God is subtle and refined, but he is not arbitrary or malicious. The social code of civility, also, is subtle and refined and requires tact in its exercise. What we call tact, Sartre notes, is connected with esprit de finesse, a thing the Jew does not trust. To base his conduct on tact would be to recognize that reason is not a sufficient guide in human relations and that traditional obscure powers of intuition may be superior to it. Einstein, we suggest, and I missed an apostrophe up above. Let's read that now. Sociologist Louis Feuer locates the social roots of Einstein's general theory of relativity in his membership in the turn-of-the-century Olympia Academy, a group recruited from, quote, the counterculture of Zurich Bern, Switzerland, revolutionary students, which was a pariah culture, a circle of predominantly composed of students of Jewish origin, Einstein, Adler, Besso, Solovine, Louis Feuer, S. Feuer, Einstein and the Generations of Science, New York Basic Books, 1974, page 54-51. So, back to the text. Jews are so unconventional, wild, rude, and crude that they're able to come up just cooler and better ideas than other people, because that's how they just are, man. To base his conduct on tact would be to recognize that reason is not a sufficient guide in human relations and that traditional and obscure powers of intuition may be superior to it. Einstein, we suggest, realized that the problem involved in the social assimilation of the emancipated Jew in the 19th century was in a way like God, raffiniert, subtle and refined, but that unlike God's, society's refinement could be malicious and arbitrary. If you hear noises in this, it's because it's people setting off fireworks. Quote, the rationalism of Jews is a passion, Sartre writes, the passion for the universal. If reason exists, he continues, then there is no, Sartre this is, then there is no French truth or German truth, there is no Negro truth or Jewish truth. It is precisely this sort of disincarnation that a certain Jews seek. The best way to feel oneself no longer a Jew is to reason. There is not a Jewish way of mathematics. The Jewish mathematician becomes a universal man when he reasons. He experiments with and inspects his intoxicating condition as a universal man on a superior level. He realizes that accord and assimilation which is denied him on the social level. Experiencing himself as coarse and crude at the level of social system adaptation, the Jew as rationalist escapes upward into another order of subtlety and refinement at the level of the culture system. He joins, Sartre writes, crude sensibility to the refinements of intellectual culture. Our analysis of Freud, Marx, Levi-Strauss, then, would seem to be applicable, mutatis mutandis, to other intellectual giants of the diaspora. Asterisk. This volume, in fact, is but a fragment of a work completed and a work in progress that deals with Kafka, Wittgenstein, Hannah Arendt, and many others. And I don't know that he ever completed that, actually, because the only other book of his I'm familiar with is No Offense, about Protestants, and that is not the one he could have been referring to here. So he may have died without completing it, or I'm wrong. But I would have to believe I would have heard of it if he had. So, and those are the two books that he produced that I know about. Ordeal of Civility and No Offense. Now, So that ends the second thing that we've learned from here. The culture and the crudeness and rudeness are seen to be essential to the Jews as a religion. And they really are loath to part with them. Some do and assimilate and blame the others, but they overall they stick to it. They see it as part of their particular genius and part of their culture, part of their religion. That is, Sarah Silverman is the type of thing that Jews will naturally produce, the way a spider spins a web. Three, we may also conclude from this essay that socialization into modernity is at best a difficult matter. It is least difficult, perhaps, for the members of the WASP core culture descended from Calvinist Christianity. They, in a sense, are syntonic to modernity. They alone were present at the creation. They alone were present at the creation. For the rest of us, it is more or less costly, more or less rewarding. Part of the difficulty, as we see in the case of Freud, is the problem of Gemeinschaft effect. Modernization invades our sentiency, demanding wider modes of feeling congruent with the civil modes of behavior needed for living among strangers. In this connection, I once wrote regarding modernization and differentiation in India, an important dimension of the tradition-modernity collision is located in the neglected domain of affect, feelings. The, quote, magical, unquote, ties of blood and amoral familism, or familism, the given ready-made intimacies of caste, ethnicity, and sect, indeed all the old familiarities embedded in ascription, render the Indian, and of course not alone the Indian, loath to trust himself to the cooler, more impersonal with sentiments such as respect and civility, ingredient in the processes of modernization. Affective modernization, in which the traditionary affect is in part dissolved, in part relocated, is a traumatic though liberating experience. For most people, it would seem, this emotional change at the everyday life level is what the long revolution of modernization is all about, is what is experienced as, to use William James's formula for radical experience, or radical empiricism, experienced as, this is how it's experienced, modernization. To acquire the affective neutrality, Parsons, or emotional asceticism, Geiger, that civilizes one into modernity is to divest one's solidary sentiments of their sacred particularity. Nation building, the legitimation of wide public authority, the establishment of a civil politics, all fine things, can wreak havoc in the pre-civil emotional life of a familistic people. These changes are experienced inwardly as a kind of secularization of affect. Schooled in Calvinist Christianity, the modernizing West has undergone its sentimental education. Are there available in the East functionally equivalent values, operating fairly early in the socialization process, which can instruct the Indian in those curious innerworldly disciplines that promote, sanction, and maintain the structures of generalized affect? Question. Including that block quote. The same question, of course, applies with full force to all of us who strive to measure up to or struggle against the exigencies of modernity. Modernization is a continuous variable. All of us, any of us, are only relatively modern, be we Irish, Jewish, German, black, or whatever. All of us are witness to the profanation of our sacred particularities. All of us suffer the pathos of the secularization process. Our third conclusion is, the modernization process is objectively anti-Semitic, in quotes. But it is also, if much less so, objectively anti-Catholic and objectively anti-Lutheran. The Catholic Counter-Reformation is an early form of counter-modernization. The quarrel continues. The differentiations of modernity are disenchanting. We have noted the resistance movement to modernity, men like Marx who create ideologies of de-differentiation at once nostalgic and utopian. For them, modernity's differentiations are bourgeois contradictions to be abolished by revolutionary action. We all know the great hatred of modernity and how deep its sources run. We've explored Freud's holding operation and invasion essentially of the full thrust of modernism. We all know, also, those who willingly submit and who have made themselves a smoothly functioning part of modernity's apparat, bureaucratic virtuosos of ascetic rationalism, specialists without spirit, sensualists without heart. We have most to learn, I think, from those heroic bourgeois who have a lover's quarrel with the modern world, exemplary men of the stature of Max Weber and Pastor Bonhoeffer. In Max Weber, the differentiations of modernity internalize themselves in the excruciatingly personal form of a human contradiction, a deep inner value conflict, the contradiction between man and specialist man, between diffuse human freedom and disponibilité on the one hand, and on the other hand, the iron cage of affectively neutral functional specificity between two loves that have built two cities. We must allow Karl Löwith, L-O-U-M-L-A-U-T, W-I-T-H, in his magnificent 1932 essay on Weber, to be our teacher. There is no better guide on how a man of Weber's inordinate ethical passion lived this contradiction, for there is no solving it. We quote him at length. And we got about 2.5 pages left, so this is about a 2/3 of a page block quote. Karl Löwith on Max Weber. Weber never presented himself as an inseparable whole, but always as a member of a specific sphere, in this or that other role as this or that other person, as an empirical individual scientist in his writings, as an academic teacher on the podium, as a politician on the rostrum, as homo religiosus in his most intimate circles. It is precisely in this separation of the life spheres, whose theoretical expression is value freedom, that Weber's individuality and the uniqueness of its wholeness reveals itself. Even here, the question for Weber was not the same as for Marx, namely to find a way by which the specific human type of the rationalized world, i.e. the specialist man, can be abolished along with the division of labor. Rather, Weber asks, by which way can man, as such, preserve the freedom of self-responsibility amid and in spite of his inescapable compartmentalized humanity? Here, too, Weber affirms this self-alienated humanity, as Marx puts it, because it was precisely this form of existence which, while not affording or offering it, forced him into an extreme freedom of movement. To act in the midst of this specialized and indoctrinated world of specialists without spirit, sensualists without heart, with the passionate force of negativity piercing now here or there through some structure of bondage, this was the meaning of freedom of movement. The salvation of the human individual as such means to him that it must take place within the ingrained attitude of specialist humanity and with regard to it. But submitting to his fate, he was at the same time already opposes it. But this counterposition has this previous subjection as its inevitable presupposition. Thus the individual as such does not signify an indivisible whole above or outside the factual compartmentalized mode of existence of the modern specialist. Rather, the individualist is a man when he stakes his whole being in each and every separate role, great or small. Thus Weber's deliberate renunciation of the universal man is a renunciation which at the same time incorporates a great demand, namely, in spite of this compartmentalization of the soul, man must ever be involved with his whole being, on the strength of passion, in all such acts which in themselves are isolated. My emphasis on forced him, says Cudahy. We see in this passage, then that was the end of the block quote, the kind of secret innerworldly discipline forced on Weber by his inner assent to the modernization process, that it fragments man. He has competing responsibilities and roles, and they're odd and weird and conflict. He's not so integrated and authentic as maybe he was before. A kind of role distance involving an ethico-religious commitment to availability, that is, all of him would be there, if needed, in even the most trivial and routinized of roles, meeting the human needs of the most ordinary of persons, wherever these needs might diffuse into ultimate concerns, beyond the specified proprieties of pattern role obligations. Employee, mother, father, that type of thing. Weber's ethic was an ethic of total human vulnerability concealed in the divisions of labor. Somewhere along the line of the secret innerworldly ethic of Weber feeds off the Lutheran doctrine of condescension in the Christological sense of condescension, and reminds us of that other high academic German bourgeois, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and the arcane discipline with which he managed the differentiations of modernity. It is in Bonhoeffer that the passionate ethico-religious earnestness of Max Weber rediscovers itself in theological form. Weber, by withholding the whole, quote-unquote, man, by, quote, condescending, quote, to the inconspicuousness of specialized roles, by remaining deliberately in the penultimate, refusing the triumphalist, flashy intimacy of this pseudo-eschatological wholeness excitement, was practicing the innerworldly asceticism of secularized Protestant Christianity. Religious motives maintained him, for him, or religious motives maintain for him the meaningfulness of the everydayness of routine Western social life. We Berrian motifs become audible as we listen to Pastor Bonhoeffer's instructions in the theological logic of insensitivity training. Block quote here from Bonhoeffer. Let us ask why it is that precisely in thoroughly grave situations, for instance, when I am with someone who has suffered a bereavement, I often decide to adopt a penultimate attitude, particularly when I am dealing with Christians. Remaining silent is a sign that I share the bereaved man's helplessness in the face of such a grievous event, and not speaking the biblical words of comfort which are, in fact, known to me and available to me. Why am I often unable to open my mouth when I ought to give expression to the ultimate? And why, instead, do I decide on expression of thoroughly penultimate, second to last, human solidarity? Is it from mistrust of the power of the ultimate word? Is it from fear of men? Or is there some positive good reason for such an attitude, namely that my knowledge of the word, my having it at my fingertips, in other words, my being, so to speak, spiritually master of the situation, bears only the appearance of the ultimate, but is in reality something entirely penultimate? Does one not, in some cases, by remaining deliberately in the penultimate, read the Alltag in German, at the everyday, perhaps point all the more genuinely to the ultimate, which God will speak in his own time, though indeed even then through a human mouth? Does not this mean that over and over again the penultimate will be what commands itself precisely for the sake of the ultimate, and that it will have to be done not with a heavy conscience, but with a clear one? Back to Cudahy as we move on to last page. Here we see the ancient Israelitish taboo on direct reference, quote-unquote, to the ultimate things, ta eschata, the eschatological and the theory of the end of times. Interiorized as theological taste, profanation is now inseparable from vulgarity. In the final count, Hanfried Müller writes, there is now in Bonhoeffer no visible difference between Christians and heathens. Emphasis on visible. The church of the future should relinquish every special ostentation. Here we witness Christianity acting back, in quotes, on Christianity itself, heterogeneously refining out of existence its residual crudities and insensitivities. All vulgar, quote, triumphalism, unquote, must go. All the creaking, embarrassing, superannuated, supernatural deus ex machina, got out of a machine, a literary device for something that's comes in and saves the day. Machinery of revelation and miracle have become literally unseemly. Christianity lives now only through the arcane discipline, secret discipline, arcane discipline, of an incognito, the hidden Christ. To be inconspicuous, you know, not up there on the cross bleeding and shrieking, but inconspicuous in your heart, yet faithful. Inconspicuous yet faithful. The secret discipline of the arcane. To perform the penultimate roles, holding fast and secretly to that which is good. Modernity, child of Protestant Christianity, acts back on its parent, secularizing it out of sight, offended by the unsightliness of its own visibility. The deus absconditus of modernity. Thou art indeed a tasteful God, the depths of whose existence, Whitehead declares, quote, lie beyond the vulgarities of praise or of power. or of the rites of the faith itself. So contrasted with the original Catholic idea of all the smells and bells, as they say, the censers and the religious iconography and the splinters of the cross and the crucifix, it's a bleeding guy up on a stick with thorns in his head, dripping blood. It's a reverse of that. There is unspeakable pathos in the figure of Pastor Bonhoeffer as he prepares to die, called to conduct his last worship service in prison shortly before his execution, Peter Berger writes. Bonhoeffer held back, for he did not want to offend his neighbor, a Soviet officer. A new offense has swallowed up the ancient scandalon. The rites of faith perform themselves in the rites of love. The ius divinum self-destructs. A new incivile is all in all. Civility uber alles. And even though you have Soviet officer who may himself literally have killed Christian preachers, and at the least is a literal representative of a regime that does so, we still, it matters more that we don't offend him than anything else, making civility the highest virtue of modernity. And that will end this rather remarkable book. I want to thank you for being with me today and through this whole book, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we will pick up another.